What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Rockcast. Jordan Budd here, and we have Heath Stevie on. Heath, you were on a while back just talking about going out west to hunt and the costs that go with that. That was like 5-6 episodes ago, I think.
Yeah, I think something like that.
Yeah, that was a popular one, I know. So we're just going to ramp that up a notch and talk about going to Alaska.
Yeah, we did. Myself and a couple friends of mine, Dean Gideon, that I go on all my out-of-state hunts with, and Steve Hall, a friend of ours from college, all got together and did a DIY drop camp caribou hunt in Alaska here, flew out of Kotzebue this fall.
That's awesome. And that article is going to be coming out probably right around the time that this podcast is released, actually. You wrote an article, and Robbie was proofing it last time I knew, and it'll be up soon, I'm sure.
Yep, that's the last I'd heard from Robbie, too. He was pretty busy between hunts and trying to find a big muley and then get all of his work done on the side.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the fall is just a busy time. I about overloaded myself this fall, but it's all good. We'll get caught up on podcasts, starting with this one.
Sounds good.
Perfect. All right, so let's just talk about that hunt and where the idea came from and how long you'd been wanting to do it before you committed to go.
This has been a hunt that we always wanted to do. And really, it would probably have been a better idea to start out with like a blacktail or a caribou hunt before the moose hunt, but we ended up deciding to do the moose hunt first and going that route. But before we even left Alaska after the moose hunt, we were looking online on our phones researching transporters for the caribou hunt. So it's been a couple years in the planning, but we had the idea that we wanted to do it before that.
Gotcha. So what did that look like? What was the first step that you guys took when like trying to find a transporter?
Oh, we did a lot of research online. Rockslide's been, there's some Alaska residents on there that have been really helpful to me on both my moose hunt and this caribou hunt. Really gave me some good tips. And once I had a few names kind of figured out, I just started doing all the research I could on them and actually called all of them or emailed them and kind of got to know them a little bit. And we ended up picking Golden Eagle for our hunt. They don't actually even advertise that they do hunts, but on their website, but anyway, it's something that they offer, and along with the fishing or sightseeing and everything.
Nice. Okay, so what did that what cost wise what did that look like?
We ended up, I figured, somewhere around $6,500 a piece in the entire hunt, and that's tags, plane tickets, lodging, that's everything all included, not just the cost of the transporter. I think they were $3,150 just for the transporter part, and then usually I try to figure tip on top of that, a 10-15%.
Yeah, so really that's pretty affordable to go to Alaska. I think a lot of people think that it's just going to be $20,000 to even step foot up there, but it's really not as bad as you think, especially if you go like that DIY drop camp. Did they provide the camp for you? Did you bring everything with?
We took everything ourselves. They do have a Northwest Alaska Outfitters, another Rockslide member, will provide camps out of Kotzebue. So you can rent a camp if you prefer to go that way. But we kind of had all of our own gear that we knew how to run and knew how to set our tent up quick and all that. So we just chose to take all of our own.
Cool. What did that look like getting it up there? Like, you know, a big tent, whatnot?
It's a job. We had... some totes and then some big QU 9000 duffel bags. But we took a big Cabela's Alaskan Guide six-man tent. The tent itself took up the better part of a tote. It was about, I think, 28.5 pounds with the stakes and everything. But we didn't really know. We heard a lot of horror stories about the wind up there and not knowing where you're going to get dropped, if there's going to be any wind protection or not. We were just a little bit worried about using our Seek outside teepee for this hunt and not having just the extra structure of that heavier tent.
Yeah. Looking back, would you ship that or would you do it the same way and take it on the plane?
I would probably do it the same way and just take it along. It's a hassle to get it through the airport, but really, we had a wheeled tote, and we stacked stuff on top of that wheeled tote. So we kind of made it manageable that way.
Gotcha. Cool. What did your total bag setup look like going into the airport? How did you pack to fly?
We each had a smaller carry-on bag, like the Kuyu Taku bags is what we used, at least a couple of us. I think Steve had a 3,000 and I had a 2,000. And then each of us had a Taku 9,000 bag, which you do have to pay oversized charges for, but our actual hunting packs and most of our gear was in there. And then I think we had two totes. We had the big tote that had the tent and basically anything that wouldn't fit in our Kuyu bags. And then we had a smaller tote that had just our food in it.
Gotcha. Okay. That's, you guys definitely had a little bit of extra than what I would usually take, but I like to do the same, pretty much the same thing, do like a carry-on, and then I could use like a hunting pack if it's 22 inches technically as a carry-on, and then I'll just have like a big bag that I check. And one thing I always like to tell people is keep your optics and your heavy stuff, which is typically your optics, keep that in your carry-on, because you can carry that thing around the airport and they wouldn't say anything about it unless it's oversized, but it's really easy to get over that 50-pound limit on your checked bag.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's what we all did, is had our optics in our carry-on bag. And we, I think going back, I saw a lot of guys, like I have an XO K2 3500 mm-hmm. that I used as my pack up there. And man, I saw a lot of people that were using those as carry-ons on Alaska Air and never had an issue. So going back, that would be one way I could reduce baggage, is by having that as my carry-on. Even though it's a little oversized, they seem to let them go right through, and then not have it actually packed inside of a separate bag that I checked.
Yep, gotcha. So what did it look like after you got up there? One thing to hit on, I guess, quick, was your food. You said that you, did you guys take all of your food from here up there, or did you get some of it when you landed?
We took everything from here. We didn't have anything that wasn't shelf stable. We had a mix of like mac and cheese and stovetop stuffing and some soup mixes that we could add caribou or else we actually took a number 10 can of Mountain House freeze-dried chicken and vacuum packed that into individual, like a group supper size portion, and kind of saves a little bit of money and has a little bit more variety than just doing all freeze-dried. We basically had freeze-dried for lunches and breakfast, and then in the evening we would have a more of a group meal.
Nice. Gotcha. Okay. So what did it look like once you flew? Which town did you fly into? Did I miss that?
We flew into Kotzebue.
Okay, gotcha. What did it look like after you got there?
Well, the first thing we did was get another COVID test. They were really strict on that.
Oh,
they,
yeah.
I ended up having three tests in about 10 days to get through the trip. Even though I had results from less than 72 hours before, they still had me retest at Kotzebue. And basically, then it's just a little ways to the Golden Eagle hangar, and one of the guys walked down there, borrowed a vehicle from them, and we hauled all our stuff down there, and we actually ended up getting out a day or early. We got out the same evening that we flew in, where we were scheduled for the next morning, so we were pretty lucky there.
Nice. All right, then did you get to pick where you went, where they dropped you off?
No, they flew us up the river until they kind of hit the caribou, and then dropped us off on a gravel bar that was long enough they could land on. It's pretty limited where you can actually lay one of them planes down up there with finding a long enough gravel bar. So they've got to pick the spots they can get into.
Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah, the flight in was pretty much worth the whole cost of the trip, in my opinion. It was a lot prettier country than we flew over when we flew out of Bethel on our moose hunt. It was just really beautiful country. Kind of went from some lower mountains into the open tundra and flew up the river bottom the whole way. And we actually saw some dall sheep on the flight in, and it was just really cool.
Yeah, that does. That sounds awesome. So once they drop you off and drop all your stuff off and they take off, what's the next step after that?
From there, we wanted to get camp set up as fast as possible. So we immediately, actually before they even took off, we were scouting where we wanted to set up our tent, because on our moose hunt, we had just a few hours after we got dropped, and then it rained for days. And so anyway, our first priority based off of that is always to get the shelter up. And once we had that up, we went and did a little glassing from a high bank off the river there, not too far from camp, and saw quite a few caribou that first night. But, you know, you can't hunt the day you fly, so we just kind of looked. And anyway, then got back and got kind of organized and ready for the next day.
Nice. So did you bring a stove at all?
Not a heating stove, yeah, for the tent. Now there's just such little wood to burn. We gathered up some driftwood in case we wanted to have a fire. And after we all got back from gathering firewood, I looked at it and it was wet enough and there was little enough of it. I said, well, I think if we spent about 45 minutes processing this, we could have about a 45-minute fire. Yeah. So we never even ended up lighting one.
Gotcha. Did you think you needed it? What were the temperatures like?
It got pretty cold. The river really iced up on our last day. It really stayed fairly mild earlier in the hunt. And I think according to the inReach, the temperature was 14 on our last day. And there was a pretty good wind chill and really damp air on top of that. So it felt a lot colder than that. But we really had our clothing layering system was good enough and had that heavier tent, you know, that really stopped the wind when we were there at camp. So we got by pretty good.
Nice. Nice. All right. So with that, let's talk about your clothing system a little bit in those temperatures.
We all had merino base layers. I had the First Light Arrow wool, and I think that's what Dean had too. And Steve had I believe, icebreaker. And then we all had a fleece or merino mid layer. Like I used the QU Peloton 240. And then past that, I had their Katana hybrid jacket as kind of a shirt or jacket to go over that. And then had the Lost Park Kafaru puffy jacket, and then a First Light Seek rain jacket. As far as the bottom half, I had the QU Yukon rain pants. I believe all three of us had those rain pants, and then we all had puffy pants of some sort. I had the First Light Yukon Pagres, and they weren't not quite as warm and windproof as what I had guessed they'd be. For that, I'd probably pick it either the next time I'd go, I'd probably either take my QU Super Down Pros or else get a pair of the Kafaru Lost Park ones.
Yeah, I think those Kafaru Lost Park Parka ones would be about as bulletproof as a puffy pant could be, from what I've heard.
Yeah, the outer material on them is a lot tougher. Dean actually had the Kafarus up there as his puffy pants, and then I've had the jacket, or Dean and I both had the jackets for several years, and they're definitely tough. You don't have to worry too much about walking through the brush with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of like down and things like that, what did you take for sleeping bag and pad?
All of us had synthetic bags. I had a Kafaru slick bag. Mine's an older 20 degree bag I've used for years, and I've been fine in it down to zero several times. But if I can get away with it, and I did on this trip, I also take a Hill People Gear Mountain Serape, and I can kind of use that as a extra insulated layer sitting around camp or glassing or anything. This is like an insulated poncho you can throw on, or I use it as an over blanket over top of that sleeping bag. So that lets me stretch my 20 degree bag and not have to buy another one.
Nice. That sounds like a good setup. Let's see. It sounds like you guys could glass a long ways up there. So what'd you do for optics?
I had my Leica Geovid HD-B 10x42s. And then I also had my little Kawa 55mm spotting scope. And then Steve just had Leicas like mine. He's got a little bit newer version of the 10x42s. And Dean, he took his Swaro I believe it's a STS 80.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we had two spotters between the three of us, and then all of us had good binoculars.
Nice. What about a rifle setup?
I've got a custom Rifles Inc. 300 Win Mag. It's a lightweight rifle built off a Model 70 that I took. Steve had a friend of ours, Flint Hills Gunworks, built him a 7 Mag. And then Dean had a 300 Win Mag built by the same place that all of us had scopes that we could dial elevation on. And that's one thing I might actually bring up, that on my rifle case flying up there, I use TSA-approved locks. And mm-hmm. that's something I would never do again.
Because
really? I shot my rifle 5 shots right before I put it in the case to go up there at home at 100 yards and hit perfect. And anyway, the Husqvarna scope that I used has a screw-on cap so that your turret's not exposed. You can't actually see where your turret's dialed to. And when I went to shoot my Caribou, I unscrewed that turret and I saw it was dialed to 475. So
Ooh. Somewhere
along the line, somebody must have decided to mess with my scope. And having those type of locks that lets people get into your case when it's not within your sight. So that's something I learned that I won't do again.
Yeah. So how does that work? Like, how's that supposed to work with, I thought you had to have TSA locks.
I guess that's what I had thought too, but none of the other guys did. You have to have the key. And so when you actually check in your gun, for the flight, you open the case and they check it all over, and then you can go ahead and lock it back down, and then they take it into their possession and have it until you get back.
Okay. Interesting. It's not good. So let's see, would you change anything? I mean, shooting 300 Win Mags, that's got to be pretty good for Caribou. What's the lowest you would go? Like, would you take like a 6.5 up there?
Yeah, it wouldn't scare me at all to shoot a 6.5, especially one of the bigger ones. I deer hunt with a 264 Win Mag, and I've got a lot of faith in the 6.5s, especially like the PRC or the Win Mag that have a little bit more speed behind them. But main reason that we went with the bigger guns is just because we were going to be in a grizzly bear area and just feel a little bit better having a bigger gun with a tougher bullet. For that, but as far as killing a caribou, I mean, a 6.5 Creedmoor, 25-06, anything like that, I think if you're picky on your shots, you'd be fine.
Nice. Okay. Let's see. So how did it unfold?
Well, we kind of hit some weather, had a lot of rain, a lot of cold, kind of misty days there early on, but we'd go up on that high bank there around camp every time the visibility would get decent to where we could see a little ways in glass, and you could see quite a ways from there, about a quarter mile from camp. And eventually the first decent day that we got, we went on a big hike, got several miles from camp and looked all around, and anyway we kind of figured out some vantage points where you could see. We found one point where you could basically see anything within 6 miles of camp. If you couldn't see it from the high bank about 400 yards from camp or just a few hundred yards south of there, that was the only area that was hidden from this high vantage point that was about a mile and a quarter from camp. So we spent a lot of time just glassing those areas. We figured if we couldn't see it within 6 miles of camp, it was probably too far for us to take off after it.
Yeah.
In that type of walking conditions anyway. We saw a group of bulls. I can't remember off the top of my head which day it was. I think it was about the third day. They're close to camp, and one of them was a really good bull, but he was broke. It had the main beam broke up on his tops on one side, and then there was another one that was a little bit smaller frame, but just a really pretty bull. And Steve decided he wanted him, and we ended up getting snuck up within about 500 yards of him before a cow started getting really nervous and kind of looking. And anyway, Steve got laid down, and I got him set up with my pack and my folded over my Therm-a-Rest kind of glassing pad that I sit on for a rear rest, and he got steady and got that bull. And anyway, we got it all packed back to camp. And one thing we did that I was glad we did is on some of them foggy days when you really didn't have any visibility early on, we got our meat rack all built and set up there at camp. So when we got Steve's bull packed back to camp, that that night there about dark. We had the meat rack all ready to go. We didn't have to go scrounge around for materials to try to do that.
Nice. Good use of time for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Then, how'd yours look like?
I got a bull, I guess the next day after Steve did, I think. We were up on that high bank there by camp, and we saw a group of bulls, and the activity had really seemed like it had dropped from what we'd seen the first night. We were starting to kind of hit. I don't think the migration was over by any means or past us, but the migration kind of comes in waves. You have times you'll see a lot, and then times it'll be pretty sparse. And anyway, one of these bulls was a pretty good bull, ended up being the best one we saw on the trip. A lot of the bulls we saw that had really, really good fronts and really long, heavy main beams didn't have anything hardly up top. And this bull kind of had a pretty good balance of frame and everything. And we saw him and a group of other bulls kind of catty-cornering away from us, going to drop down into the river bottom. So we covered ground as quick as we could for about a half mile. And as soon as they dropped into the river bottom, we really hustled as fast as we could and got set up and ended up having to shoot standing over my optics tripod. And I ended up killing him at 300 yards and he just went right down. Had to get our waders out. We had Wiggy's waders to, had to cross a stream to actually get over to him. And then we got him packed back that evening. And then we really hit a lull, didn't see anything until our second to last day. And a group of bulls and cows, I guess there's probably 20 of them total, came through. And there was it wasn't as big of a bull, but it was getting late in the hunt. And Dean decided he was going to take it. And he ended up making a big old loop around. He left all his gear with us and got over to him. And he'd left his Wiggy's waders with his pack and everything up with us because we couldn't see that there was a stream between us and them. Uh-huh. And so Dean, actually, we couldn't figure out what he was doing. He was sitting down on the edge of this little brush line. And the caribou just kept working closer, and he waited him out and got about a 330-yard shot and got his bull. So then we packed everything down to him and got loaded up and got it packed back to camp there. I guess we had one more full day in camp after that. And that's when the temperature really, really got cold and it got windy. So we were pretty glad to be tagged out at that point. We just kind of hung around the tent and camp area that day.
Yeah, I bet. Those waders, what's the setup on those waders? I got to use some Sims when we were in Alaska, and that particular model, I think it was the Pros, you had boots that went along with the waders that you had to put on after.
That's what we used on our moose hunt. I had like Sims G3 chest waders. Yep. And then the G3 boots. And they work really good if you're going to be in them a lot. These Wiggy's waders are just like, I think they weigh 14 ounces. And they're just a nylon sleeve, basically, that slides over your hunting boot and everything. So you don't have to take your boots off. You just slide this over them. They're just good for stream crossings. They say they don't hold up, you know, long term. But everything we had to cross was pretty smooth river rock. And I bet we had them on maybe 10 different times, you know, just to cross something and take them back off. But with the amount of hiking we did compared to the moose hunt, it was a lot more comfortable option than wearing chest waders the whole time.
Oh, yeah, that sounds about right. What's the cost on those Wiggies?
I think they're like $80 or something. They're really not that bad. They're pretty handy to have. I'm going to have them with me a lot when I go to the river catfishing in the summers. And if I get the boat stuck on a sandbar, I'll be able to slide those on in the spring when the water's a little cold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a great option for even for here, too, on the river.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what did bringing the meat back look like? You know, per Alaska regs, don't you have to have everything bone in?
Yeah, yep, we did. We packed everything back bone in. We actually donated a lot of our meat. We brought back 100-pound box of meat, but Dean Gideon's wife has a friend that works at the nursing home where all the village elders are at in Kotzebue there, and they got I don't know how they pulled it off, but they got something passed to where they could actually feed wild game in that nursing home. So we'd been in contact with her, and she came down there with her four-wheeler, and we loaded up all the quarters on for her, and she took them back to the butcher there at the nursing home, and they were really tickled to get it. The elders, that's what they always have eaten, is the wild game, and they really like to get to eat that rather than chicken or beef.
Oh, yeah. So, and then flying it out, how was that?
Oh, it wasn't bad. We had a fish box that we bought from our transporter, and we just boned out what we could fit in it, got it up to the 100-pound limit. And anyway, they had enough room in their freezer that we could stick it in there. We actually plan our hunts for Alaska to have a day usually on the front end and 2 days on the back end before our flight out, just so if we get weathered in, we don't have to mess with changing flights. And so anyway, it was in the freezer there at the hangar long enough to get froze down good, and then we just took it home as a checked bag.
Nice. That sounds like a good plan. We just had, it wasn't Alaska, but we just had some guys come out that ended up be a little bit more expensive option, but they just shipped a cooler here, and they actually bought a Yeti cooler and just had it shipped here. And then when they were done, they could fill it up with meat after we froze it, and then they took it home with them as a check bag on the flight. And that seemed to work really good. Then you don't have an extra bag on the way out.
Yeah, that would be a really good way to do it. One of the guys I went with is actually a terminal manager for FedEx, and he did a bunch of checking on the logistics on the shipping end. And he kind of figured that it was easier, or it was actually cheaper to take it on the plane as a checked baggage with Alaska Air than it was to ship everything up and back. Because we looked at that as far as all of our camping gear, too, if it would be easier to ship it up there. But ended up just kind of dealing with the hassle of hauling it rather than shipping it early.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. So anything in there that you want to add or anything that you would change?
A few things that I might add that really worked good for us. I took a pair of a Crispy Highland Pro boots up there, and they're kind of like a boot with a boa lacing system, and then they have a gaiter built into them, so they're waterproof all the way up to your knee, but they actually tighten down on your ankle and fit like a regular hiking boot. And I was really glad to have those. Those worked awesome crossing all the water that we were in, and it saved me a lot of steps. Times that the other guys with a regular leather boot and gaiter would be trying to go around something, and I could just kind of plow right through it. And I actually figured out that the tussocks were a lot better, a lot less unstable in the standing water. A lot of times it was ankle deep or so, and so I ended up doing a lot of walking through the water on purpose just because it was a lot better footing. And then another thing I did that we used a lot is I took a pair of Tingley brand ultralight rubber boots, just regular rubber shore boots, and I cut them off at ankle height and bought them a size too big for me. And those were my camp shoes rather than having Crocs or anything like that. And they only weighed about a pound set up that way. But anytime anybody'd have to get up at night to go outside and go to the bathroom or anything, we just left them by the door of the tent. And whoever needed them could slip them on quick and go in and out and still have something waterproof on your foot.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds like a really good setup.
Yeah, everything's always so wet in Alaska. We don't take anything except rain pants up there anymore. We've decided we're not even going to take a normal hunting pant and always have a waterproof camp shoe that you can get in and out of easy. I guess one other thing is we took an MSR wind burner set that I've got that's got a 2.5 liter and a 4.5 liter pot and then a skillet and a burner for those, and then I also took a MSR wind burner, little 1 liter personal, to carry around with us for doing meals out in the field away from camp. But anyway, that was a little bit of redundancy that worked really well for us because both of our stoves took the same burner. So anything that we wanted to, if one stove failed, we had the other one, or if we wanted to have two burners going at the same time to make a camp meal in the evening, we just fired them both up and really worked pretty well.
Yeah, that sounds great. And that wind burner did really well?
Yeah, it worked really well.
Perfect. Yeah, that's perfect. I did a review on those. It was like a jet boil, the wind burner, and then the reactor. And the reactor did a little bit better than the wind burner, but at a cost, for sure. And I thought that wind burner was about perfect.
Yeah, I looked at the reactor. They looked like they were really nice, but if I remember right, looking at it, I don't think the reactor had like a full, like a camp set like this one did, to where I could have the redundancy of having both of them. So that's kind of what pushed me that direction.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yep, that reactor, the way that the pot sits on the burner, it does really good at blocking wind, but it leaves that burner exposed, so there's nothing, you couldn't even set a pot on that thing if you wanted to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this little setup's got kind of skillet, and the pots are all built to kind of lock right onto the burner, and it works pretty slick, really.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Let's see, anything else? Anything food-wise that you would change?
Not really. We fried up a lot of caribou in that skillet. We ate some grayling, too. We caught quite a few grayling off of the gravel bar where they dropped us, and those were really good eating. We had those a couple times, and yeah, we just had like some of the Bear Creek or Shore Lunch soups, instant stovetop stuffing and instant potatoes and ramen. And then we had just our freeze-dried meals. But some of those you can kind of beef up, like with have a stroganoff freeze-dried meal over instant potatoes and stuff like that. Worked out pretty well. Well, that fresh caribou loin made all those side dishes or meals better.
Oh, I bet it did.
And we were pretty flexible on when we would eat our, like, our big group meal that we had planned for the day. If it was all socked in the morning and there wasn't any visibility, we might eat our supper for breakfast and then, you know, go out and hunt the rest of the day and eat a freeze-dried deal at dark when we got back.
So. Uh-huh. Nice. Game bag-wise, I don't think I talked about that.
No, we had the Argali. Two of us had the Argali, and I think Dean had the, I can't think of the name of it. It's the one Camo Fire sells, like their game bag set. But all of us kind of had the better game bags, mm-hmm. and they worked really well. We had everything hanging there off of that meat pole, and it all held up really good. We had Steve actually went out to go to the bathroom at about 2 o'clock in the morning one time, and he saw eyes in his headlamp, and it was the only time he said he didn't think to take his gun out with him when he went out to the bathroom in case of bears. But there was actually a wolf there at our meat rack right in camp, and it took off. And anyway, we went out there the next morning, and we could see where our caribou had. Steve's had been drug a little ways, and mine was kind of tangled up. I had a rope on it. It was kind of tangled around the meat rack, but I guess they didn't get our quarters out of the game bags, but they tried to work on the head a little bit. After that, we tied all the antlers onto the meat rack so that they couldn't get drug off as easy.
Yeah, probably. That was probably a good plan. Speaking of wolves, how did that work with tags? Could you kind of get whatever you wanted?
We had each of us had a caribou and a wolf tag. We had wolf tags were like $60, so we figured we just as well add those.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't actually, other than that one Steve saw at night, we didn't ever see a wolf. We saw the tracks in the, kind of the black sand there, that one the next morning that he'd spotted, but we never did see a bear, and saw two sets of bear tracks, and one set was made while we were at camp, while we were out hunting one day or overnight. We saw it on our walk back to camp there on the same gravel bar, but we never did actually lay eyes on a bear.
Gotcha. Did that transporter, do they have anything to do with the tags that you get? Do they limit you at all?
Not really. I guess we never really asked about that. We just told them what we had. I think basically everybody probably gets the caribou and wolf tag.
Yeah.
And there's really not a lot else in that area. It was pretty wide open tundra for the most part. The moose and everything were closer to town in the more timbered areas, I think.
Gotcha. Okay. So what did getting that meat out of the field, did they have to take multiple trips?
They had a pair of Cessna 206s they flew us in and out with.
Nice.
And they didn't have any trouble. With a group of three hunters instead of four, we had plenty of weight capacity to haul it all out in one trip.
That's perfect.
Yeah, it worked really well.
Yep. And then, so it had to be, that meat had to be bone in. Could you debone it once you got back before you flew?
Yeah, once we got back to the hangar, they had a table that we could use, and we deboned what we were going to take home. But actually the stuff that we donated to the nursing home, they wanted left on the bone. I think it's something with the regulations maybe that that they can take donated meat, but they have to butcher it themselves and do the boning out and all that about there. So,
gotcha. And then what about the heads? What'd you do with those?
While we were still out in the field, we had enough downtime there one day when the glassing conditions were bad that we got them all skinned out and got the brains out of them as best we could out in the field and got them all cleaned up. And then we had antler boxes that we shipped them home in. And I actually had to saw an antler off of mine to fit in the antler box. But I took a magic marker that they had there at the terminal or at the hangar, and I put four marks down the antler and down onto the skull to let the taxidermist use that to kind of line it up how it actually sat. And anyway, I haven't got it back yet, but I guess he's getting it figured out on how to do that. And we did get a little bit of bad advice. We packed a bunch of our sleeping bags and clothes and stuff in there around the antlers in the antler box because we were told that you can do that to free up space.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually going to put our 100 pounds of meat in one of our totes that we freed up by doing that. And when we got there to fly out, they told us that the only thing that can be in the antler boxes is the antlers. And us and another group were tearing all of our luggage apart and repacking everything at the last second there in the middle of the terminal. But we both got it done in time to make the flight. So that's no-no, I guess. The only thing that can be in an antler box to be shipped back is just antlers.
Just antlers. What's that antler box look like? I didn't know you so the last one I did, like, that was a podcast like this about Alaska. I think Sean flew his antlers right back on Alaska Air Cargo, and it didn't sound like he needed a box, but maybe.
Well, on our moose hunt out of Bethel, we were able to just check the moose skull as a checked bag without anything on it. I guess they're a little bit stricter. The transporter said that we should use the antler boxes just to avoid any trouble. I think it's a little bit stricter maybe there than Bethel was or something, but we didn't argue with them. We just used the antler boxes. But last time we just had the antler tips covered and had everything wrapped in shrink wrap real well. So if there was anything left in the skull, it couldn't leak, and they just took it as a checked bag. And so anyway, that's something maybe worth asking for people when they figure out what town they're going to fly in and out of. Call the airport and ask how they want it done.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And then those antler boxes, is that a transporter deal? He provides
those? Transporter had them available for us, yeah.
Gotcha. Are they pretty durable?
Yeah, they're just basically like a cardboard box with a little bit of a light wooden frame inside of it. So,
nice.
Yeah, they held up pretty good for what we needed them to.
Gotcha. Okay. Good. Yeah, that's something people should probably ask about, too. I'm sure all those transporters have that stuff covered, but be worth a ask.
Oh, definitely. And that's something that I kind of wanted to hit on, too, is during hunting season, those transporters are really, really busy. And that's not the time to get your questions answered. It's a good idea to get all that stuff kind of hashed out and get a hold of them, you know, months ahead of time. Even if I was going next fall, you know, here after the first of the year would be a great time to start getting all that stuff hashed out, just because those guys are really running hard during hunting season, and they just don't have the time, or they're out in the plane and not available to answer all those questions. And I've kind of figured out that the easier you can make the transporter's life, the better they can make your hunt. Just have your gear all squared away and packed neat and just be organized. That's both of our hunts. We've actually got to fly out a day early, just by being ready to go basically when we got off the commercial plane, and we call them and tell them we're in town. If you get a window, you know, we're ready to go. And it's bought us an extra night in the field twice now, so it's something we're definitely going to keep doing.
Nice. How did that work with them getting you out early? Like, say, is it just something like, all right, this is the date that we're going to bring you out on, and even if you tag out early, we can't really get you out early?
Well, we had the in-reaches, so we could talk to them if we wanted to get out early. But what I was getting at, I guess more, I probably didn't explain that very well, was on the front end of the hunt, being able to go out early.
Yeah.
On that, by having all of our stuff basically ready when we got off the commercial plane, we were organized enough we could just go straight to the hangar, and mm-hmm. if they had a weather window and time, they could take us out that day before we were actually scheduled to fly out. And as far as on the back end, when we were tagged out, we gave them an in-reach message and told them that we were tagged out, and that if there was any reason on their end that they needed to, they could take us out early, but otherwise we'd rather stay in the field, you know, that last day and just do some fishing and enjoy it. We didn't end up doing much fishing that last day because of the weather that got so cold, but we were still glad that we stayed because the clouds finally cleared and we saw the northern lights really, really pretty that night. And that was the only time on our hunt we were really able to see those. And that was something that I really wanted to see while we were up there. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Those are super awesome. Man, is there anything else you wanted to add?
I think that kind of covers it. That was the kind of what I was going to end on, was that about the try to be as organized as you can and make the transporter's life easier during their busiest time, and it'll pay you benefits off in the end. And I guess one last thing to hit on there would be that when those guys are really busy, they kind of expect all their clients to be fairly self-sufficient. So knowing how to handle your meat, how to do the boning and all that, it's not the type of hunt where a transporter doesn't do any of the work for you, and they might not even be there to give you advice. You may just be left in the hangar while they're out flying other people or you know, getting their work done. So for anybody thinking about going into these hunts, just do your planning ahead of time and kind of know any skills or have any questions asked that you think you might need before you get up there and have to figure it out on the fly.
Yeah. Yep. I totally agree with that. Is there anything, shoot, I had another question. I keep forgetting it. When people are planning this stuff, the best thing to do is just to start it and to go. I think instead of just, I guess, sitting on it and just hoping that you're going to go. 'Cause it's really, like you said, $6,500 per person for everything. That's not just to fly in, that's for your whole trip.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I've tried to stress to anybody who's talked to me that's thinking about it, is just not to wait. None of us are getting any younger, and I was actually had a friend growing up that I went on my first elk hunt with, and I went on hunting trips with him when I was still in my late teens and early 20s, and he preached that to me a lot, is just find a way to afford it and go, because if you wait until you have enough money to make it easy to go, you'll wish you'd have started earlier, because you'll start losing your health. And I've just turned 41 here this summer, so I got a lot of years of doing it left in me, but I don't want to miss any of them. I was sure glad that COVID didn't cost us this year of getting a hunting trip in, because Alaska's kind of in my blood at this point, and I want to go back as many times as I can.
Yeah, what are you planning?
We're actually planning a Kodiak trip for Sitka Blacktail in 2022. I think four of us are going to go up there. So we were starting to research that online before we ever flew out of Alaska this trip. So.
Uh-huh. Yep, Kodiak is fun. I spent 13 days there on a goat hunt, and it rained 11 of them.
Yeah, I saw some of the pictures of that. Were you up there with the SIG guys?
Yep, we were.
Yeah, no, that looked pretty cool. I was kind of looking at Kodiak and thinking that I may even take the Helly Hansen rubber rain gear on that one instead of just the breathable stuff. I haven't decided yet. But it looked like it could really be wet.
Yeah.
I don't think I've been on a trip to Alaska yet when it hasn't rained on at least half of the days, so.
I know, and my prior Alaska trips have all been pretty dry. So this one was a little bit of a change, but yeah, we all wore the First Light Seek stuff and got along well with it. I did bring two sets of it just in case, but I never had to use that. I had those boots. A lot of people have been asking me about the boots, so I'll just throw them in there real quick. Dang it. I'm really screwing this up right now. Oh, Rapaches. Who makes... The Salewa Rapache boots. I've been wearing the heck out of those. And, man, I think they leaked in Alaska. I still need to do a bathtub test with them. But we crossed a creek. I got the top of my sock wet. But it was just damp. Like, it just barely went over. And when I got to the top of the mountain, my feet were freezing after we stopped to sit down in glass, and I don't think that my feet could have sweat that much. So
yeah, that's one. I was really happy with those tall boots, and they were like $600. They were really expensive. But I was kind of fighting plantar fasciitis all summer, and since last fall on the ranch, I had a rainy stretch, and I wore some lacrosse mud boots that the insoles were shot in for too many days straight, sorting cattle and everything. And I kind of screwed my feet up, and I've been fighting that pretty well all the way up to this hunt. And I sure didn't want to go into walking the tundra without a boot that had really good ankle support. And I was really happy with those Crispies for what I was doing. I imagine that's probably what I'll end up taking to Kodiak, and unless we go earlier in the year. It kind of depends on how we end up deciding to do it, but having that ability to walk through water up to your knee while still having a comfortable hiking boot was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Did those have insulation?
I think they're like a 200 gram. They do have a little bit, but it's not too much. It's about as much as I'd want probably for hunt where I'm going to walk very much.
Yeah, no kidding. Just enough to hopefully keep some of the chill off.
Yeah. Yep. One thing I could mention, Dean, he took a couple pairs of boots up there a pair of Danners and a pair of Asolos that he'd had for several years, but had been really good boots for him. And he had them all treated up and waterproofed really good. But from that constant wet, they started falling apart on him. And he had a pair of Gore-Tex socks that really saved his feet. He said that's an item that, you know, doesn't weigh very much and is something he'll always have along from now on.
Good to know, a Gore-Tex sock.
Huh. Yeah, I hadn't really even heard of him until he told me he got them for the hunt, because he figured if his boots failed, then he'd have one more layer of protection between his keeping his inner sock and foot dry. So he was really happy with them anyway.
Yeah, that sounds like a dang good deal. Man, I'm trying to think. Anything else? Would you change the tent setup at all?
Probably. That's kind of hard to say. If I knew that we were going to be in a river bottom where we had a pretty good windscreen on three sides from brush, we found a really nice camping spot. If I would have known that going in, I would have went with the teepee just because it's lighter and would have worked just as well. But that tent really did a good job for us, and having those vertical walls, it let us have three cots. We had like a Helinox, or I think two of us had Thermarest and Steve had a Helinox cots, but we could set three of those across there and get slept up off the ground. And I guess you asked about pads earlier, and I never did hit that. We all had the Thermarest X-Therm pads, and nice. They worked really well.
Nice. With those cots, too. That's awesome. Did those cots work pretty good? Since you had two brands, did one look better than the other?
I'd say they all are pretty equal. I had mine is the Thermarest. It's the mesh cot. And instead of they've got an ultralight, I think, that has a solid fabric floor in it, I guess you'd say. But I went with the mesh one because, like on scouting trips when we're truck camping, I'll take it just because it's cooler. And I figured I can always get the extra warmth from a pad. And then if I'm on a scouting trip and want to take a midday nap or something, we run back by camp in the middle of the day. It's not so hot to sleep on then.
Yeah, that sounds really nice. What's the weight on those?
I believe it's like 4.5 pounds.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's somewhere right in there. It's not super lightweight, but we basically were allowed like 250 pounds for the three of us. So we had a pretty generous weight limit on this deal.
Yeah, if you would have had a fourth person, would that have gone down or not gone down?
No.
It probably would have stayed.
No, I think they would have. 80 pounds a person is what they advertised.
Gotcha.
But then they told us that if you're going to consume it in the field, they're more worried about the weight coming out. So, like your food that you know you're going to eat in there, you can get by a little bit with a little bit of leeway there. long as you don't try to, you know, they still don't want to be overloaded coming out. So you got to stay pretty close, but gives you a little bit of room.
Gotcha. Well, is there anything else? Do you want to just give a, like that charter service was really good to you guys?
Yeah. Yeah. Golden Eagle, they did a really good job for us, and, you know, and they were really busy. I mean, I think that's probably going to be true for all of them. You know, if you're wanting to somebody to sit around and visit with and kind of be buddies with, you're probably better off going with a guide, because these guys are trying to get people in and out, and they just pretty much did their jobs and left us on our own other than that, which was fine for our group. It's just, I think people looking at going need to kind of decide what experience they're looking for and plan accordingly.
Yeah, perfect. That's great advice. Well, I think that's all I had. Everybody can just look out for that article that's going to be coming out and give that a read.
Yep. And the article is kind of the story of the hunt. And then I did a post when we got back. I think I called it What I Learned on My First Caribou Hunt, that's under the caribou thread or forum there. And I really went into detail on gear on that one and kind of went through everything that we used and a few tips. And so anyway, anybody wanting to kind of read basically a version of what we're talking about here could check that out too. So.
Perfect. Yep. I'll link to both of those down in the description, and that'll be a quick way everybody could get to it. And yeah, if there's anything you want to close out with, go ahead.
Nope. I'd say that's perfect. Good. It's get it figured out and go. You're not getting any younger.
Yep. That's perfect. All right. Thanks, Heath.
Thank you.